Thank you. I hope this lecture lives up to that introduction. If any of you were not here yesterday, one way you can catch up with the last lecture would be to take the handouts that gives you my... don't do it now, but the handouts from yesterday, which are my analysis of the social world of each of the four Gospels, a sort of stratification of characters in the Gospels, where they fit on the social spectrum. And those of you who were here will remember that one of the interesting results is that although the spectrum runs right at the top, even the Roman emperor, to right down at the bottom, the outcasts, but there's a notable proportion of non-elite people, ordinary people, and especially notable is how many of the poor and the outcasts appear. It really is a significant concentration of those people. Now, what I want to do first of all is contrast that with ancient history from above. The contrast between the social status of the characters in the Synoptic Gospels particularly and those of Greco-Roman historiography and biography in general could scarcely be more stark. The latter are exclusively concerned with the elite, whether as political rulers, generals, philosophers, or poets. When non-elite individuals appear in these works, it's because they are needed for a story about the elite. And even so, the non-elite characters tend to be retainers rather than the common people. The common people occur only as large collectivities, the people, the masses, the mob, or the troops. Two examples will briefly illustrate the point: the historian Polybius and the biographer Plutarch. Polybius's history of the Roman Republic's rise to dominate the Mediterranean world was sometimes regarded as a model of the best kind of historiography. He wrote it after a distinguished political career of himself, of his own, and the aristocratic values of heroism, glory, honour, and duty pervade Polybius's work. Among other things, he aimed to provide a handbook for politicians, an exploration of good and bad statecraft. Of course, good and bad statecraft include managing the common people, but Polybius never finds it necessary to refer to them other than collectively. I hazard a quite well-informed guess that no individual of the common people is to be found anywhere in Polybius's lengthy history. I haven't read the whole of Polybius. Someday I must check this out by reading absolutely everything of Polybius. I find him rather dull, to be honest. Certainly, if there is any individual of the common people, that person is very rare in his work. And aristocratic disdain for the common people, which was standard among the elites of the Greco-Roman world, appears in Polybius's frequent reference to the masses as stupid, greedy, driven by irrational anger and moral perversity. And this same aristocratic contempt for ordinary people is found in the work of Plutarch, who wrote the largest collection of biographies that we have, largest collection of biographies that was written in antiquity, and actually 50 of them survive. All of these are of rulers, generals, or orators. But in the genre of biography, as distinct from Polybius's history, in the genre of biography, Plutarch is able to accommodate smaller matters of personal life, as distinct from the great affairs of state that history is largely confined to. One might expect, therefore, that more of the non-elite would appear in Plutarch's work than in Polybius. And it's true that there are indeed a few, but only a few, and always really there for the sake of the part they played in stories about the elite. So that's a contrast with representative historiographical and biographical literature. Now I want to say something about the life of Apollonius of Tyana, because this is a biography of the figure among ancient biographies that many people think is most resembles Jesus. So it's an interesting comparison, I think. Apollodius of Tyana lived in the 1st century AD. He apparently lived for most of the century, so he's contemporary with Jesus. But the biography, and remember what I said yesterday about contemporary biographies being the real way to do it, Apollonius's biography, the biography of Apollonius, there were actually probably more than one, but the one we know, was written in the early 3rd century. At the request of the Empress Domna, and written by Philostratus, who was an aristocratic philosopher who belonged to the Empress's literary circle at court. So we're in this world of royals and elite people very much. Now, among ancient biographies, this is remarkable for its length. It's the longest known biography, and it's some 35 times as long as the Gospel of Mark, so you get some idea of its length. Now, scholars have discussed the reliability of this as history, to the extent that, or alternatively, the fictional character of it, some kind of mixture of history and fiction is clear enough. But I'm not going to go further into that issue. Apollonius has often been compared with Jesus. In fact, this was done at least as early as the early 4th century. One of the pagan critics of Christianity, a man called Hierocles, compared Apollonius and Jesus to the disadvantage of Jesus. And the church historian Eusebius of Caesarea wrote a response to Hierocles' book, which I'll mention again in a little while. Now, within the very broad and heterogeneous category of holy men in this period of ancient history, it probably is true that Apollonius resembles Jesus most. They are actually the only two such figures about whom a series of miracle stories have been preserved. But the differences are at least equally significant. And one of these is the social status of those in whose company they are mostly to be found. According to Philostratus, Apollonius himself came from an aristocratic family, the wealthiest in his area, and had an expensive education. He is an itinerant Pythagorean philosopher, severely ascetic, renouncing wealth and all kinds of luxury and comfort, conveying his moral and religious message both in public preaching in a direct and oracular style, and also in private conversations with individuals and groups. That's fairly similar to Jesus, of course. Unlike Jesus, he travels as far as India and Ethiopia to converse with the sages of these places. He lectures the assembled citizens of Greek cities. His typical conversation partners are other philosophers, students, emperors, kings, and members of the Roman aristocracy. A few individuals of the common people appear in these stories, but they are rare. And again, they tend to appear for the sake of stories about the elite. Now, perhaps the most interesting material for comparison with the Gospels from the sort of angle we're coming at this in these lectures are the stories of healings, exorcisms, and other kinds of miracles that benefit particular persons. And the individuals whom Apollonius helps, apparently by supernatural means, can be assigned to social groups thus. Among the elite, there is, for example, a girl from a consular family, Roman aristocratic family, whom Apollonius raises from death. There's a dissolute man of aristocratic family whom Apollonius exorcises. There's a wealthy man short of available cash, and Apollonius helps him find buried treasure. There's a man called Menippus, who is a student of a philosopher, and Apollonius exposes the vampire who has enthralled him. Make a good modern popular novel, wouldn't it? Fifthly, a boy bitten by a mad dog. There's just one other character whose social status is unknown. He's a guy who's wrongly accused of being a bandit, and Apollonius helps him escape execution. Now, some of these stories are more or less inconceivable in the Gospels. For example, there's the man who keeps a large household full of idle servants, but he's going to have to spend all his capital, 20,000 drachmas, on dowries for his four daughters. Apollonius is sorry for him and helps him find a buried treasure of 3,000 gold coins. The story of a girl who died at the hour of her wedding and was raised to life again by Apollonius bears some resemblance to Jesus' healing of Jairus' daughter. But whereas Jairus belongs only to the elite of a small Galilean village, Apollonius's beneficiary, the girl's father, belongs to one of the wealthiest families in Rome. When her relatives offer Apollonius a reward of 150,000 sesterces, he presents it to the young woman as her dowry. So despite his own renunciation of wealth, which is part of his philosophical vocation, Apollonius moves apparently in a world of really serious money. Now, I mentioned Hierocles, who wrote a tract against Christianity, and Eusebius, who replies to it. We don't have Hierocles' work, unfortunately. Eusebius quotes some bits and pieces from it. And it is interesting, this piece I'm going to read you, to see how Hierocles, this pagan critic of Christianity, sees the contrast between the Gospels and Philostratus' history of Apollonius. And he does see them, I think, in terms of the contrast of social level. In the terms I've been using, one is history from below, the other is history from above. But of course, he much prefers the latter. And this is what he says. Whereas, he says, it is Peter and Paul and a few others of that kind, men who were liars and uneducated and magicians, who have made a boast of the stories about Jesus. The stories about Apollonius were written by Maximus of Egai and by Damis, the philosopher who lived constantly with him, and by Philostratus of Athens, men of the highest education, who out of respect for the truth and their love of mankind, determined to give the publicity they deserved to the actions of a man at once well-born, aristocratic, and a friend of the gods. And this is actually one of a number. We don't have too much pity, really. We don't have too much of the pagan critique of Christianity in the early period. But there are a number of pieces which I think add up to the fact that unsympathetic readers of the Gospels were struck by the non-elite perspective and didn't like it. They didn't have my terminology to distinguish from above and from below, but I think they clearly recognized the differences I'm pointing to. So, most ancient history, actually I say all ancient history and almost all ancient biography, concern the elite virtually exclusively, and of course were read only by the elite. But were there any exceptions? And I think I'm only aware of two. Both of these are biographies. There's the life of Homer, great poet, of course, by Pseudo-Herodotus. There are several lives of Homer. This one is wrongly ascribed to Herodotus the historian. So there's Pseudo-Herodotus' life of Homer and an anonymous life of Aesop. Homer, of course, was the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey. He's kind of Shakespeare of the ancient world, only more so in how he was regarded. Aesop was the supposed to be the author of the fables of Aesop, which were very popular reading in the ancient world. They're very different works. I'll say a bit about each of them, but they both are set in the world of the non-elite people, and they present the perspective of non-elite people on the social world of their time. Aesop, then, the other thing to say is that both of them, of course, are very ancient people. I mean, they're way back in antiquity, from, you know, if you're living in the first century. They were both written more or less around the New Testament period, as far as we can tell. And people at that time, you know, looking back to Homer and Aesop, they're way in the distant past, virtually legendary figures. I think, you know, modern scholars would certainly regard them as legendary people. First century people had no doubt that they existed, but they are very remote figures chronologically, and both of these lives are therefore entirely fictional. Did their readers regard them as fictional is an interesting question. I think very likely they did. I find it hard to believe that people really, really thought that these were historically reliable lives. And so, you know, in terms of the map of ancient biography and neighbouring genres, which I talked about yesterday, whereas the Gospels, I think, belong on the point of the map where biographies are very close to historiography, they call them historical biographies, these two biographies really belong on the edge where biographies are related to novels and fictional literature. So we're at a very different place on the map of biographies, but the fact that they are unusually biographies from below does make them of some interest to us. I'll spend a little while just telling you something about these. Aesop, author of the fables, is depicted as a slave, phenomenally ugly, and in the ancient world, as I think in many societies, elite people particularly look, you know, they think of the people at the bottom of the scale as sort of typically very ugly. Ugliness sort of belongs to that sort of view of the aristocratic view of the world. Aesop is a slave, and until he's healed by the goddess Isis, he's deaf and dumb, so he's also disabled. But he's very clever, and repeatedly he gets the better of his master, the philosopher Xanthus, and humiliates him. And after tricking Xanthus into setting him free, making him a freed slave, he becomes a famous philosopher, advisor to kings. But his clever words and fables cannot save him in the end from the anger of the people of Delphi, whom he insults by calling them free slaves, freed slaves. So Aesop is a slave from the bottom of the social order who inverts it in a way. He humiliates his elite master, proves to be a much better philosopher, and himself rises to the top of the social order, or near the top. Keith Hopkins refers to this work's nightmarish understanding of all that might go wrong in a master's control over his slaves. That's how elite people might react to this story. So is this work therefore a serious attempt at turning history upside down? For two reasons, I think we should be wary of this. The first is that the narrative is comic. I mean, the main feature of the narrative is clearly that it's comedy, told for laughs. And you can, of course, have a serious purpose in writing comedy, but comedy perhaps makes what might otherwise be a very disturbing view of the world for the elite, comedy makes it harmless, perhaps. If you can laugh at it, it's not so threatening. But the other point is that there's a sort of ironic ambiguity of the matter of turning things upside down in the final part of the work that refers to Aesop's death. And he gets into trouble with the people of Delphi by calling them freed slaves. Insult, of course, they're no better than freed slaves. And standing on the edge of the cliff, which he's about to leap to avoid being pushed over it by the Delphians, Aesop says, "I am upset that I shall die not at the hands of reputable men, but at the hands of these wretched slaves." So in the end, the slave forgets that he was a slave himself. He adopts the perspective of the elite, and things actually sort of turn back into the proper social order right at the end of the story. So most likely, a lot of scholarly discussion of this work is just sort of unusual in the ancient world, very interesting. But most likely what we have here is a comic work that plays with the idea of inverting the social order for the entertainment of the elite. Now let me say something else about the rather different life of Homer by Pseudo-Herodotus. And this is set even more in the world of the common people. Homer himself comes from humble origins. Early in his life he becomes blind. That, of course, was a tradition. Everybody knew that Homer was blind and begins composing poetry. For most of his life, he's a vagrant, wandering from city to city, supporting himself from his poetry when he can, but denied any official recognition or sponsorship, and often reliant on the charitable hospitality of ordinary or even poor people. He's taken in by a shoemaker, by a schoolmaster who then plagiarizes his poems, and by a goat herd, a slave called Glaucus. And eventually he sets up his own school as a very ordinary sort of schoolmaster. Now, at various points in his life, Homer performs his poems for ordinary people, the people who hang around in the shoemaker's shop, the old men sitting idly in the town square, you see all over the Middle East still today, and visiting merchants. He improvises poems for sailors and fishermen and fisher boys, the goat herd, and for potters. So he's very much in this world of artisans, small traders and so forth. The world of the common people. Now, all it's very interesting because all of this is so different from the world of the Homeric epics, which are very much the royal aristocratic world. The life of Homer, therefore, places the poet in quite different contexts from those that he wrote about in his well-known epics. And unlike the bards in the Odyssey, there are lots of people who appear in the Odyssey as composers of poetry, performers of poetry. But in the Odyssey, they're all connected to royal palaces, and they sing for the entertainment of the elite. But Homer, in this life of Homer, never recites his poems to the elite, but to all these ordinary people, as I've mentioned. You might think this would be very surprising, really, for people who knew the great epics of Homer to suddenly find him immersed in this world. One reason why I think it might not have been so surprising to an original audience is that in this period, 1st and 2nd century AD, Homer's poetry was performed in the theatres. There were professional performers of the Iliad and the Odyssey. People took parts and so forth and acted it out. So Homer was not only a staple of basic education, which everyone had any education would know, but was also accessible to uneducated people who merely had to attend the theatre, as lots of people did. So Homer really was a sort of common cultural possession across the social spectrum. Now, one of the things that this life of Homer does is to claim that the various benefactors Homer is indebted to in the story, people like the shoemaker and the schoolmaster and the goat herd, appear in the Iliad and the Odyssey as minor characters. So it's arguing, really, pretending that the minor characters in his epics, the major characters, of course, were imagined to be very well-known, real historical figures, but the minor characters, it's suggested, are Homer's, the people Homer knew. He's sort of rewarding their goodness to him by putting them into his poems as minor characters. But what happens is that they go way up the social scale when they appear in the Iliad and the Odyssey. So this work does, I think, adopt a perspective from below, portrays Homer as a man of the common people, distinctive only for his divine gift of poetry, and much of the time he belongs even among the poor, the people really near the bottom of the scale. There's none of the aristocratic contempt for working people that one finds in most Greco-Roman history and biography. What could possibly be the social context for such a work? And it seems to me that if we remember that the great poems of Homer were performed in the theatre, where a whole cross-section of people attended, it looks to me very likely that this was designed for those occasions. It's quite easy to imagine in the theatre, elite, but especially non-elite people, hearing the great poems of Homer performed. Those people would greatly enjoy, surely, we can imagine, discovering that characters in Homer's epic were actually modelled on ordinary people like themselves. In the epics themselves, you don't meet any ordinary people. They're all aristocratic high. But Homer has socially elevated these people. So the idea, I think, is that ordinary people would be able to think, oh, at last, actually, there really are some people like us in Homer. It's just that they're the ordinary people he knew, and he has, as it were, increased their social standing by putting them into the epic. So I think this is rather interesting for comparison with the Gospels, because you do have in the theatre, you know, a social spectrum, perhaps not quite to the bottom, you know, outcasts wouldn't be in the theatre, but you've got a social spectrum which is surely rather like the social spectrum of the early Christian communities. So you've got literature which, in both cases, appeal to audiences where actually the common people would be the majority. So the Gospels are not, I think, completely unique in their portrayal of the world of ordinary people. And we can't really know whether there might have been other popular biographies of this kind which haven't survived. But we need to remember that big difference between Homer and Jesus. Homer, though a greatly revered figure, was a figure from the remote past, and nothing really survived to allow anything more than a fictional representation of his life. Jesus was a figure within living memory, and so were those characters in the Gospels. Some of these farmers, fishermen, beggars and outcasts were well known in the early Christian communities, greatly respected members of the early Christian movement, and many of them still around, certainly when Mark wrote his gospel, some even later. So there are some resemblances and some differences in that case, but it's worth just repeating that these biographies from below are very exceptional in the ancient world, so far as we know. So let's now turn back to some features of the Gospels. And up till now, the data that has supported my argument that we can see them as history from below has been the prominence of individuals from the common people and the lower classes. We can now turn more briefly, however, to the collective presence of the common people in the gospel narratives. We've already noticed in Polybius and Plutarch the contempt for the crowd that is common in aristocratic writers. The topic of the crowd in the Gospels, if you think about it, the crowd turn up all over the place in the Gospel stories, could do with a lot more study, I think, than it has received. And all I'll do now is make some rather general comments. To do this in detail, of course, one ought to look at each gospel in turn. I'm producing a sort of composite picture because I think the general view of the crowd is common to the four gospels. So I'm trying to do this as well as I've just got time for in this lecture. The terms that the gospels use interchangeably for the common people are plethos, which means the multitude, hoi polloi, the many, and oklos, which is the word for crowd. Perhaps surprisingly, they don't use the word deimos, which was often used in ancient... It's the word from which we get democracy, deimos. Gospels don't use it, but they make liberal use of the word oklos, which generally in elite literature carries a pejorative meaning. But only once, I think, in the Gospels is the word oklos used in that sort of sneering, pejorative way. And this is in John 7:49, where the aristocratic Jerusalem Pharisees, who compose, along with the chief priests, the ruling body in Jerusalem, they say, "But this crowd, which does not know the law, they are accursed." Now this deftly, I think, on the evangelist's part, combines the general aristocratic contempt for the common people, which was normal in the Roman Empire, with the special disdain of these Pharisees, who mean that the uneducated common people do not know the scriptures well enough to see that Jesus cannot possibly be regarded as the Messiah of David because he doesn't fit the scriptural prophecies. And clearly there's also in the context an echo of the idea the Pharisees had that the common people just didn't really observe Torah properly because they didn't follow all the details of the Pharisaic reading of Torah. But this kind of aristocratic contempt of the people, especially the point that they don't know the scriptures so they can't identify with Jesus, is clearly in John's narrative not meant to, as it were, include us in that contempt, but quite the opposite, because the crowd, or some of them, have actually correctly identified Jesus from the evangelist's perspective. So the contempt is, as it were, turned on its head, and we are invited to be negative about the aristocrats, and the crowd comes off rather well in that instance. But that's the only point, a point where the evangelist, as it were, draws on the general aristocratic contempt for the crowd and gives it a place in his story. The story of the plot of the chief priest to arrest Jesus and put him to death is also dominated by this kind of attitude to the crowd. The chief priests are terrified of the common people, who at Passover time form, of course, an unusually large gathering of people in Jerusalem. The chief priests, you remember, hesitate to arrest Jesus because he's so popular with the crowds. And this is typical of the way the ruling elite view crowds in ancient historiography, where the mob are a frightening threat to the social order, and its behaviour is driven by uncontrolled emotion. Wise rulers can keep the mob in order, but the fearful potential of the mob is unleashed when a demagogue, some self-seeking politician, an aristocrat greedy for power, flatters the masses and wins their support and, of course, mobilizes them in defiance of the ruling group. Jesus was not an aristocrat, but in every other respect, I think, it seems that the Jewish ruling classes perceive him as a dangerous demagogue. And also the irony is that in the end, the chief priests themselves resort to demagogic practice when they stir up the crowds to to demand Barabbas rather than Jesus from Pilate. Now, this point is, of course, the point at which the crowd who have hitherto supported Jesus withdraws its support and calls for Jesus to be crucified. So this is the point where the crowd does, as it were, flip into a more negative role. They turn out to be fickle, which was often a view of the crowd in antiquity. But what the passage is doing, I think, is portraying Jesus as steadily and totally abandoned by anyone else. You know, first, the disciples have deserted him, and now the crowd are crying for his execution. One mustn't, therefore, be too generalizing about the crowd. It does change its attitude. But it remains the case that generally in the Gospels, the crowd appear fairly positively. They flock to Jesus from all over the place. They bring their sick for healing. They listen to his teaching and so forth. And they're impressed by Jesus. In the end, they fail. But of course, so do the disciples. Nobody really comes off well in the end of the Gospel, apart from those few women who remain faithful to Jesus. So I do think the portrayal of the crowd is in marked contrast to the characteristic elite perspective of Greco-Roman history. Now, just to remind you of something I said about history from below when I introduced it as a modern approach to history. As practiced by E.P. Thompson and others, history from below is not just about the non-elite classes or individuals of the non-elite classes. It's actually history seen from the perspective of the non-elite classes. And crucially, in the history seen from this perspective, the common people are agents of their own history. Traditional history, political, military history, views them largely as the objects of the deeds and policies of the ruling elite. But history from below reveals, in Thompson's words, the agency of working people, the degree to which they contributed by conscious efforts to the making of history. Now, I also pointed out yesterday how difficult it is actually to identify the agency of ordinary people in the ancient world because of the limitations of our sources. But I also argued that the Gospels are remarkably different in this respect, and they really do offer us the perspective both of the crowd and the common people en masse and of individuals, many of them from the non-elite strata. Does this enable us in any way to see the non-elite people as subjects of their own history, as taking a hand, as it were, in how their world develops? Now, the Gospels, of course, are, apart from anything else, Jewish salvation history. And therefore, the chief agency in history is that of God, and the chief human agency is that of the Son of God, Jesus, who carries out God's purpose. But this stress by the Gospels on the agency of God and Jesus by no means renders the recipients of salvation passive or powerless. Actually, quite the opposite. And when we look for this, it's really quite interesting how Mark, I'm taking again Mark as my example because I can't do the whole thing here, but Mark, in Mark's case, the common people are really quite active in the story. So I'll mention first the crowd, then individuals, then the disciples. The crowd, we see it in Mark's summaries, they come from near and far to Jesus, bringing their sick and their demon-possessed with the faith. Remember how important that is in the Gospel, the faith that Jesus can heal and deliver. Secondly, individuals healed or exorcised. Again and again, the people healed by Jesus not only voice their faith, but show it in the way they take action to reach Jesus' healing touch. The four friends of the paralytic, you remember, show their enterprising faith by digging through the roof to get him into Jesus' presence. The hemorrhaging woman presses through the crowd to touch Jesus' garment. The Syrophoenician woman has to think on her feet to persuade Jesus to heal her daughter. Bartimaeus ignores the people who'd have kept him out of Jesus' sight, and despite his blindness, blunders his way into Jesus' presence. To both the woman and the beggar, Jesus says, "Your faith has made you well." A very one-sided, at best, statement, we might think, because, of course, their faith would be no use at all without Jesus' own healing powers and activity. But it's a statement that emphasizes the active agency of the people Jesus heals. The exceptional case, of course, is the demon-possessed people, because faith cannot be required of them. They're deprived of personal agency by the demons. They can't do anything of their own. But in two cases, the faith of a parent is involved in the deliverance of the demoniac. But the deliverance of the demoniacs is also related to personal agency in another way, because it frees these people so that they can now, for the first time since they were possessed, become agents of their own history. And remember, to one of them, the man called Legion, Jesus gives a mission to spread the good news around his locality. And then finally, the disciples, because as well as healing people, Jesus repeatedly calls people to active discipleship. "Follow me," he says on the first such occasion in Mark, "and I will make you fishers of people." And Jesus shares his own mission by sending out the 12 to do the same sorts of things as he has been doing himself. Thus, the impression the Gospels give, or this Gospel of Mark in particular I'm using as the example at this point, the impression the Gospel gives of Jesus' ministry is of all kinds of activity going on around Jesus, centered on Jesus, but by no means confined to his own activity. Jesus becomes the center of a mass movement, which is precisely why the authorities in Jerusalem see him as a demagogue inciting the masses. Well, one person's incitement is another's inspiration. But the simple picture of Jesus enabling people, as it were, to take history in their own hands, their own history in their hands, and to change it, which comes through in a good deal of the Gospel, as I mentioned, but it's complicated in the story by the steadily gathering indications that Jesus' way is going to lead him to the cross. And the future looms not as what Jesus will do, so much as what will be done to him. He will be betrayed, rejected, despised, mocked, beaten, and killed. Those passion predictions have a lot of detail there about the things that are going to be done to Jesus. But even actually in this suffering, in a deeper sense, Jesus' action can be seen at work, because of course Jesus voluntarily undertakes this path in obedience to his Father. But the movement that Jesus led, this mass movement, crowds of people from all over Palestine, is shattered by these events. The disciples give up, the crowd are disillusioned, and as we've seen, in a certain sense, both the crowd and the disciples betray Jesus. So to all appearances at that point in the story, the ruling elite has shown that in fact it does still hold the reins of history. The spectre of mob rule, the disruption of existing order, always feared by the elite in the ancient world, has been dispelled. Assured of this, the chief priests themselves visit the scene of Jesus' crucifixion in order to taunt him with his failure. Mark's narrative brings us to the point where all the activity of Jesus' ministry, his own and others around him, ends in failure, only to identify that failure as the point at which God acts to transform human agency in history. Jesus' movement, inspired of God though it was, has to come to this end in order to be reborn in a new way. Truly, to save oneself, one must lose oneself, as Jesus says. So the last section of this lecture is called Jesus Crucified. History from below can go no lower than the cross. It was a cliche of ancient writers to call crucifixion the worst of deaths, it's Porphyry, the most wretched of deaths, that's Josephus, the most cruel and disgusting of punishments, that's the Roman politician Cicero. Because it was the most painful way to die, it was also the supreme penalty in Roman law and was reserved especially for slaves and outcasts, which made it therefore also the most shameful of deaths. Crucifixion was the way the ruling elite disposed of people of no importance or made those who threatened the social order into people of no importance. The Roman elite themselves, of course, were exempt legally from this penalty, whatever crimes they might commit. The extreme cruelty of crucifixion matched the constant fear of the elite that their own household slaves might murder them in their beds, that slave revolts might overturn the whole Roman Empire. And remember, if you've heard this, that 6,000 slaves were crucified at the end of the slave revolt led by Spartacus. Or they were afraid that violent rebels in the provinces, the bandits that hung out in the hills, would plunge the Pax Romana into turmoil. So the extreme cruelty of crucifixion was regarded as a deterrent to others who might think of doing such things. And hence the very public context of crucifixion and the placarding of the crime for which the victim was executed, in Jesus' case, King of the Jews. The felt necessity of deterrence, the fear of social disruption requiring this kind of punishment to maintain the social order, explains why, although Greek and Roman writers acknowledged the barbarity of crucifixion, there was no protest against its constant use. It was the uncivilized means of maintaining civilized order. Martin Hengel points out that many Greek and Roman writings, including political histories, including memoirs of generals like Julius Caesar, rarely mention crucifixion, although in fact it was frequently occurring, frequently ordered by the heroes of these narratives. The historians were more likely to record its use by barbarians than by Romans, and they rarely go into any detail. As Hengel puts it, crucifixion was widespread and frequent, above all in Roman times, but the cultured literary world wanted to have nothing to do with it. So it is that the Gospel Passion narratives are the fullest accounts of an actual crucifixion that have survived from the ancient world. Even they do not dwell on the physical cruelties, which all readers knew well enough, but there are details that make the gospel accounts descriptions of this particular crucifixion rather than just a generalized account of what crucifixion would be like in any case. Remember, Jesus was too weak to carry the crossbeam himself. He refused a narcotic, which is Jewish custom, offering a narcotic to a criminal. His hands and his feet were nailed to the wood, which was not always common, but not always method of hanging the criminal on the cross. His height on the ground was apparently greater. His height above the ground was apparently greater than was always the case. And he died unusually quickly, you remember. Taking the physical torment as read, the Gospels give more attention to the taunts and mockery that began in Jerusalem with the soldiers' charade and continue while Jesus hangs on the cross. And these are highly specific to Jesus' own case, revolving around his messianic claim, the crime which was placarded in the inscription above his head. Joseph Fitzmyer interestingly points out that that placard on the cross was the only thing to our knowledge to have been written about Jesus during his earthly life. The contradiction between King of the Jews and the condition of a slave or outcast that crucifixion declares him to be is fruitful ground for the mockery of those who witnessed it, but also for the writers and readers of Gospels, it's at the heart of the meaning of Jesus' death as purposed by God. It's important to note that by crucifixion, Jesus was degraded to the lowest place in the scale of social status. Or one might almost say that he was actually thrown out of the social order altogether and disallowed any place in the social order. The Gospels don't make very much of Jesus' own social status. I discussed that yesterday, but it only comes up very occasionally in the Gospels. The Gospel narratives take for granted that Jesus is a man of the common people himself, but far more important than Jesus' own status is the company he keeps in the Gospel. Jesus is not taunted for being an artisan, but he is taunted for being a friend of tax collectors and sinners. And he actually acquires the social stigmata of the people with whom he associates. So in John's Gospel, he gets treated as a sinner, he gets called a Samaritan and a demoniac. And when he's arrested in Gethsemane, he's treated as a bandit, as he will become on the cross between two bandits. Not common thieves, you wouldn't be crucified to be common thief. People who posed a real threat to the social order. So Jesus dies as one of those in the company of others. So in a way, this final social degradation of Jesus, the shame of the cross, the death of the slave and the outcast, is the consequence of his own self-degradation during his ministry, when he made such a point of mixing not simply with the common people, but with the poor and the outcast, the dregs of society. In this way, the Gospels enable us to see the cross as the climax of Jesus. The term I like is to talk about Jesus' loving identification with people of all sorts and conditions. Something we can observe in those charts of social status in the Gospels that we looked at yesterday. Jesus' friends and disciples and those he heals do come from all strata of society. The elite are not excluded, but a significant tendency towards the lower end of the scale is very clear. Those who were the least important socially, Jesus makes the most prominent in his story. And therefore the Gospels make visible the sort of people who are normally completely invisible in ancient literature, especially in historiography. What the historians and the biographers shy away from recording in the case of crucifixion, the Gospels expose to full view and make, in a sense, the climax of their story. And this, I think, more than anything else, makes them a sort of history from below, so unusual in the early church. It's Jesus himself, the way he takes, the people he associates, the fate to which he voluntarily goes. These make Jesus' crucifixion itself the factor that turns history upside down. Now, Jesus' identification with the lowest of the least is not exclusive of others. The point, rather, is that if Jesus' identification with others goes to this furthest extreme of degradation, then, of course, it encompasses all people. These are the least likely to be encompassed and therefore make clear Jesus' identification with all people in human society. But the elite can follow this crucified Jesus only by transformative recognition of his solidarity with the outcasts. In a sense, what happens at the cross is the collapsing of the whole social spectrum into its lowest point. For this outcast is the king. And the contradiction is resolved either by the mockery of those for whom no outcast could possibly be king, or by the disturbing recognition that this king comes to his kingdom not by stepping into the highest place, but by self-degradation to the lowest. And this is how he establishes the kingdom in which there are no outcasts and no elite either, only siblings and friends, the terms Jesus uses, who compete to serve each other, the last first and the first last. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, there was a lot of fruit, especially in that last section. I'm glad you didn't make the decision to maybe skip it or something, because that really much to explore. I do want to take a few minutes for questions, but I'm also going to take advantage of asking a couple myself first here. If I might, first a clarifying one, I'll just answer them all and you can take them. When you're discussing the biography of Aesop, was your implication that even though that might appear to be an exception of elite biography, even that one might itself be elite and might be sort of making fun of? Was that part of...
Yes, exactly. It's playing with the idea of overturning the social order, but I think really for entertainment.
Right, so even that one is still elite in that sense. Yeah. But the Homer one might still
be... The Homer, I think, is quite different, and I really do think, because the problem of talking about popular works in the popular literature is what sort of context could they function in?
Right.
And I think those performances in the theatre, where Homer was actually performed, would actually provide, a whole cross-section of society would be there in the theatre. So I think it's very plausible that the life of Homer was meant to be read in that context,
well, and
would then especially appeal to the sort of common people in the audience.
Right. Well, and that leads to my second question, and it was firing some synapses of connection of some recent work done on the Gospels themselves as oral performance, at least the Jesus tradition, certainly, but even the Gospels themselves as maybe being something that were, obviously they were at least read aloud, but maybe even to some degree performed, and with statements like, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear," and even then, "let the reader understand," as Mark 13:14, I think, believes he says it. They're sort of conscious of their own being performed, as Graham Stan and others have pointed out. I'm curious if you might comment on that, if there might be some fruit in connecting the oral performance of the Gospels with the Homer in that context. Have you thought about
that? Yes, indeed. I mean, I think Homer is a good example of, it's a poem, but they perform it, and they would have actors taking the different speaking parts in the story, and people seem to say that actually it developed even to the point where they dressed up as different characters and so on. So that must have made Homer much more accessible to the ordinary person, people like acting and so forth. It's easier to connect with what's going on in the story. I wouldn't go so far as to suggest the Gospels were performed by people putting priestly hats on or things like that, but I think it would be natural for people to read them with a lot of expression and the sort of thing, and gestures and so forth. I mean, we get so used to just sort of reading aloud in church, where you just stand there and you read. I think they would most likely be more associated with performance than just reading. And again, it's when you think that most of the audience were illiterate, you can imagine the Gospels communicating so much better if they're read with expression and acting and so forth, gestures.
Wonderful. And finally, my third one, and please do come to the mics if you have some other questions. Kevin Rose's relatively recent book on Acts and the turning the world upside down, I can't quite think of the title. I thought of that as well in terms of one potential implication of history from below. The crucifixion is a great example of implication of seeing that in light of this history from below, sort of social perspective of the Gospels. But I wonder if, speaking politically, tying it in with something you said yesterday as well, if we might see the history from below perspective of the Gospels being an intentional, not political overthrowing worldview of Christianity, but a subversive through cultural, you know, transformation, social transformation is one way to connect those sort of ideas. Any comments on that?
Yes, I think that's right. In the first lecture, I actually suggested the word anti-political biography in the sense that they're offering a new, a kind of different vision of society from that which comes across in the political biographies of the time. And I think this is one angle of that. Of course, it's not politics in the way that was generally thought of. But when you realise that politics in the way that was generally thought of was what the politicians and the generals did, politics in the sense of sort of, if you think of politics as influencing the way human life is lived, changing the world, not necessarily in sweeping ways, but here and there in small scale ways, that sort of transformation of human life, you could say is political in that it's doing what politicians are often trying to do, but it's doing it in a different sort of way. So Jesus is the king who doesn't just reign over his subjects. He's the king who gets really down in the social order with them. So it's a different kind of approach to how you change human life, I suppose.
Yes, I was just wondering if you could respond to something I've heard about, since the gospel is being a history from below, some people regard that as a weakness to their historical veracity and things like that. How would you respond to claims like that?
Yeah, I think it is interesting that what we have of pagan critique of early Christianity. I mean, the good example is the pagan philosopher Celsus in the second century, which Origen wrote a reply, and he preserves great chunks of what Celsus wrote. But what we know of this is it does all seem to come from this elite perspective which despised the common people and which therefore finds the sort of origins of Christianity among the common people ludicrous and despicable and not worth paying any attention to. Celsus talks about the resurrection. You know, he just appeared to one crazed fellow and a hysterical woman. You know, women and children are important in Christian gatherings. You know, this is just sort of despicable. It's quite difficult, I think, to realise quite. You know, because nowadays, doubtless there are people who are contemptuous of ordinary people, but they don't say it too much because it's sort of so un-PC to imply anything of that sort. But in the ancient world, the aristocrats were quite openly contemptuous of the ordinary people. And it really is a major feature of the literature. And Christianity really was a movement which challenged all that, you know? And at that point, of course, it's important that the movement did encompass aristocrats, members of the elite, because, you know, it's therefore creating a kind of society in which you've got some elite people, you've got some real outcasts and so on, and they're forming community in which this kind of despising of other people no longer takes place.
In your from below perspective, I was called right back to the words of the Magnificat, you know, where he hath scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He hath put down the mighty from their seat and hath exalted the humble and meek and filled the hungry with good things, but the rich he hath sent empty away.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could comment about if there is an element of turning the disdain that the rich have on the poor to sort of an equal disdain, and if that has, you know, if that has a place in the Christian community, particularly with the prominence of liberation theologies and these sorts of things that are
yes.
batted about
yes.
today.
Yes. I mean, the danger of things like social revolution is that they just invert things and you know, the revolutionaries become just as much tyrannical despots as the people who are overthrown. I mean, it's just a common feature of history. And that's why, you know, to create something like a new social order, it's not good enough just for the oppressed to revolt and replace. You've got to have new values which replace the values of the older society, in which the aristocrats were contemptuous of the others, and the others, of course, didn't much like the aristocrats. They've got to be new values, and I think that's part of what Jesus is doing when he talks about his disciples should relate to each other, wash each other's feet, those kinds of things.
I've been wanting to ask you if you think the Gospel of Thomas was originally written to be historiography, but in relation to your talk today, I'd like to add to that the question, by comparison with the Christian Orthodox Gospels, would the Gospel of Thomas have had much appeal to the common people?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. The Gospel of Thomas is so difficult to resolve, you know, what the Gospel of Thomas is trying to be and where it's come from and so on. I'm waiting for Simon Gathercourt's major study of the Gospel of Thomas. It has hardly any action. It's virtually all sayings of Jesus. And in that sense, it's sort of unlike anything else, actually. I mean, some people think Q was rather like that, but in terms of extant documents, it's rather unusual. And I think it does reflect, this is highly controversial, but I think it does reflect a Gnostic approach in which what matters, and this is true of the clearly Gnostic Gospels, what matters about Jesus is that he came from heaven to give us enlightenment, you know, so that we see ourselves and the world truly. And enlightenment is what sort of takes us into the world of the divine. So Jesus doing things, healing people, you know, all those kind of actions of the kingdom, and still more, of course, his crucifixion. I mean, these things don't matter to Gnostics. It's what Jesus taught, which is important for them. And I think that what the Gospel of Thomas probably is a selection of traditional sayings of Jesus, probably from one or more of our canonical Gospels, but also from some other sources, because there are sayings we don't otherwise know. But they're a selection of sayings that were amenable to a Gnostic reading. And that's why it's so difficult, you know, you can dispute whether they're Gnostic or not. They're not sayings that have been sort of written to be Gnostic, but they're traditional sayings of Jesus that are subject to a Gnostic reading. Now, the interesting question is what sort of social world is going on here? And there's very little indication within the Gospel itself. But and that's the question, actually, who were Gnostics? And there is quite a... I mean, the Gnostics were very elitist people, by which I don't mean being aristocrats particularly, but sort of spiritually elitist, you know. The Gnostics are the special people who have this divine spark, and most people don't. So it's very elitist as a religious concept. And also... if you read the Gnostic Gospels, you know, there's all this kind of strange mythology and stuff. It's quite difficult to understand. In a way, it's very sort of intellectualizing, but at the same time, not what the philosophers wrote. It's a different kind of thing. It seems almost a sort of pseudo-intellectual kind of writing. So I think Gnosticism may well be a movement of, you know, would-be elite people. People are trying to create their own little world. They're the important and intellectual people. But there's a certain amount of guesswork going on there. But in that sense, if that's true, I think very different from the sort of encompassing world of mainstream Christianity, where you know, you're including people from all walks of life and parts of society.
Okay, you said the elite were not excluded when you talked about the outcasts and things like that. Mm. Just for clarification, is that because the ultimate outcast is actually the ultimate elite, the king? Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. why, or did I miss something else, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. why that is, mm-hmm. that they're not excluded?
Yes, they're not excluded, but to be part of a society which no longer values those kind of status positions and so forth, they've got to, as it were, put all that aside for the sake of belonging to this community. In other words, they've got to really recognize that Jesus includes outcasts and poor people, and that they can only be followers of Jesus along with those outcasts and common people. So they can't have their own sort of aristocratic Christianity. It wouldn't be what Jesus was about at all. It's the need for them to actually recognize the humanity and the value of the ordinary people that they're used to despising. To follow Jesus, they've got to do that. It's a kind of repentance, of arrogance and so forth, social climbing and all those kinds of things. It's the kind of repentance that the aristocracy has to go through to belong to the new kind of community. That's what I was trying to say, I think.